who is doing, who are, is, do, doing, are, doing, do, okay, the, I, M, P, R, E, E, A. Oh, but the attorney was the second guy was the guy. I think he's a professor or something who's been working on the impeachment of Bush.
Oh, of Bush. Yeah, yes. I don't know those folks, but yeah. I've heard of it.
Yes. But in both cases, in these two separate interviews, the interviewer asked each of these two people if they, one of them said, well, has anybody come knocking at your door yet? Mm-hmm. And in both cases, both people answered no, but they fully expect that will happen, mm-hmm. and they are already figuring that they'll end up in prison at some point, and that mm-hmm. that's okay with them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so far I'm not aware of this happening anywhere yet, but it's clear that with the loosening up of all of the laws, it's going to be a lot easier to go after political activists or anybody who just, you know, marches to a different drummer. If the authorities want to do that, the way is a lot clearer now than it was before the Patriot Act passed and before a lot of these other, you know, I think the DMCA as well.
It is H.A. happening, M, U, much, F, faster, then I thought it would happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's going to be a tough time now for a while, and I don't know, you know, we all work as hard as we can to resist. I think there's safety in numbers to a certain extent. The more people step up, the better. But it is, I think these are scary times, and I don't see it getting better sooner. I'm hopeful that by the time of the elections that maybe there'll be enough people angry in this country that will throw some of those people out of office. And try to begin to repair. Mm. The other thing to remember is that, you know, I mean, ultimately I'm an optimist. I think that things get better.
Yeah. You have to be?
Yeah, I think you have to be. Otherwise you give up, right? You go, I mean, I have some friends who are talking about leaving the country or going to the woods.
Yes. That is how, what, they, what they want.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think that, I mean, I've taken great heart from the anti-war protests and from the growing movement to try to stand up against Hollywood as well. I think that, I mean, I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say the tide has turned, but I think that when you look at this period of time, I'm focusing on the war a lot now because it's on my mind. At this point in time, you know, in Vietnam and previous things, you didn't have nearly the public outcry that we have now. And so that, to a certain extent, gives me hope that maybe things will turn around faster. But they got to turn around. I mean, they're headed in the wrong direction.
On the on the other hand, in the 60s, it was not as K.O. You out F R O out front. In the '60s it wasn't as out front.
The attacks repression. On civil liberties, the repression. Yeah, it's true. It's true. But we had some horrible things happen in the '60s as well.
We always T H O thought O U our P H O our phones were tapped. Then but P E people said that you were being paranoid.
Yeah. Well, now we've had the Freedom of Information Act and we've discovered that they weren't paranoid enough,
that's,
right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
A million people, you know, they had records on over a million people. Million Americans. It's amazing. There's only 200 million of us, right?
That's
just, it's an incredible number. Every time I look back at the Church Commission reports and the stuff that came out, I'm stunned at the size of it, at how much surveillance really was going on. And they didn't convict anyone, right? There was no criminal activity, at least not sufficient to warrant any convictions.
We just saw a D documentary on how the CCHU Church Commission R E A really S I side stepped M O most of the real issues.
Yeah, I think it's true that it would be interesting to really talk to Mondale and some of the people who were on the Church Commission. I think that what they found, even at a preliminary level, was so shocking that they, you know, they did tremendous things with it. Mm-hmm. And I think you might be right that there's probably even bigger story there that was too much to come out at the time. Mm-hmm. None of the things that's scary to me about the Patriot Act changes is the new level of government secrecy and the pulling back from the Freedom of Information Act. I think it's going to be hard to learn all of what has gone on. It's been hard now. And the EFF since September 11th has been waiting for cases involving online surveillance, and we're standing ready to help people. And I think the reason that we haven't heard anything that we can really get our hands around in terms of trying to pull together a legal case is because most of what's been going on has been going on under gag orders. And restrictions so that ISPs and people who are being asked to turn over information are being threatened with liability themselves as they come forward. I know the librarians have said this has been happening to them.
Yes.
And they're among the most courageous folks. I mean, everybody, I hope, knows that librarians are the heroes of our time.
Michael Moore tells his story about his book. Did you hear the Michael?
And
the librarians raising hell.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. You know, I mean, I hope, you know, I eventually think that, and I think that most Americans are good people and that they don't want to see this happening. But I'm continually puzzled at how the elections tend to come out. I really think that one of the things that the right or the, you know, the forces of oppression have done, I don't want to say right and left because, frankly, on these privacy issues, the folks on the voices on the right have been as loud, if not louder, than the voices on the left.
Yes.
It's not a partisan issue.
Yes.
But the folks who are allowing this sort of repression to happen, I don't, you know, it's confusing to me. But I think one of the things that's happened is they've convinced over 50% of Americans that it's not worthwhile to vote. And I can't help but believing if more people would actually participate in the electoral process, we wouldn't have these people being elected who are taking away our rights.
And obviously, we need people to vote for. We need people to. We need people to vote for.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And you know, the system isn't just broken on the top level that people aren't voting. It's broken all the way down to for who gets the gets selected to be on the ballot.
It is. Not A P A apathy that keeps people from voting.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. But we've had some good candidates, you know. I mean, I didn't think Bill Bradley was the best candidate, but he was certainly better. He was certainly not a bad one. And frankly, I thought Tom Harkin, when he ran, was a good candidate. I mean, I'm a Democrat, so I look at things from the left. And they can't make it past the primaries. You know, they can't make it past the party structure. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in electoral politics. I'm a litigator. I take things to courts, frankly, of the three branches of government. The one that I think is, you know, is the best use of my talents right now is the courts. I worry about the courts as well, given the election of so many. The selection of so many people who are very, very conservative, yet at least the folks who aren't have life tenure and they don't go away. So there are still hopeful spots on the judiciary. And I think the judiciary, while they've had a mixed bag, has said no to the administration in some ways, certainly much more than Congress has since September 11th.
What? When? When have they said no?
Well, there has been lower level decisions about calling someone an enemy combatant, refusing to allow them to have lawyers. You know, they've consolidated most of the September 11th stuff in the Fourth Circuit, which is awful. And there's just a series of bad decisions. But there's been some good decisions out of New York. There was a tremendous decision in the lower court. I want to say in Cincinnati, somewhere in the Sixth Circuit. So you know, we'll continue to work. I mean, I just. You know, it's hard. We're in a really deep hole, I think, people who care about liberty and freedom. And it's going to take pressure in all sorts of different areas. You know, I would never come forward and say, oh, well, we have to just forget Congress and forget the administration and just go forward with the courts. But I think we have to use all of, we have to push on all three branches of government. And then, of course, push on our media to give us real information and push on, you know, ourselves. To stand up when something's wrong. Yeah. And my favorite story since September 11th is this little dive shop that I represented that was asked to turn over information about people who had taken dive classes but hadn't finished, just turn over their entire records to the FBI. And they called me and they said, we don't feel right about this. This doesn't seem right. There's no indication that any of these people are terrorists. If they want to tell me about a specific person who they have, they're building a case against, then maybe, but they just want everything. And I don't feel right about this. And I took the case and called up the U.S. Attorney's Office and said that we were going to fight it. And the U.S. Attorney's Office backed away. And those records are safe now. And we need more people to do that, to stand up.
Any C L U clue why they did it
well
in the first place?
The only thing the FBI agent told my client that they had a tip that the next terrorist attack was going to be an underwater explosion, kind of like what happened with the USS Cole in Yemen. And so they were gathering all the data of all the certified divers in the country. And in fact, they had already received all of the information about people who were certified divers, which includes me. I was a PADI certified diver. Because the dive organizations just turned it over.
U M U you must be a tea?
Yes.
A terrorist?
Yeah, I must be a terrorist because I went down with the definitions. Exactly. And this was what the, you know, my client, who's a dive master, said, is the idea that anybody who took the little Patty course, you know, it's a little six-week course, and you can go down and look at the fishes. The idea that you would be a terrorist is as silly as thinking that everyone who has a driver's license is, you know, going to drive a building, you know, drive a car into a building and blow it up. And then, you know, we have a word for this in the law. It's called a fishing expedition, right? That law enforcement's supposed to have a target and go after it and not just suck in as much information as they can. But so they had this rumor and they were going around sucking this information. And this was apparently why. But faced with the prospect of having to explain to a federal court why they needed this information from this dive shop, they backed down, which is why I say courts may not be perfect, and I think our courts are in trouble, but the fact that I could force the government to go to a judge and they didn't know what this judge would say was, I think, the reason that they backed down. They didn't want to have to explain why they needed this, what you and I saw immediately, which was the idea that every person who'd ever taken a dive class was a terrorist was ridiculous.
Every, even, F, R, O, from, the, P, O, point of view, even from the point of A, I, N, V, investigator.
Yeah.
You. Don't. Do. You don't get. T. O. N. Of. Tons of. Information.
Right. It's not good investigative strategy either, you know, as a person who pays my tax dollars to try to help them catch real terrorists, the idea that they were spending their energy on this rather than a real terrorism investigation struck me as very troubling, too. You know, I don't claim to try to tell them what to do their work, how to do their work on a micromanage, but it doesn't take a specialist to realize that this is a misuse of their time. In fact, this is a general problem with some of the surveillance and data gathering stuff, TIA, the Total Information Awareness Program, that's going to try to link up all these databases and suck in information about us. There's no evidence that the problem that the government has in catching terrorists is a lack of enough data. In fact, the opposite is true. It's that they're not very good. They don't have good tools, and they're not very good at figuring out the wheat from the chaff. They're drowning in data. What they aren't very good at is figuring out what matters versus what doesn't matter in all the data that they have.
In, is, it, R, E, A, really, T, E, terrorists, or T, R, trying, to see, control people?
I don't know. I don't claim to know these things. I mean, I think there are bad people in this world who are trying to do us. Now, what's going on in a particular instance, I don't know, and I'm not a specialist to know. I mean, my job is to try to make sure that the internet and digital media remain free, because I view them as the kind of the plumbing of free speech. And the only way we can tell these things, is it a really terrorist threat or is it a control issue, is if the information flows as freely as possible and people can talk to each other and they can float ideas and they can do investigations and they can really find out. I don't necessarily have a, you know, I have my own personal views, but I don't think they're particularly, they're not any more informed than yours. What I think I can try to do is to try to make sure that things flow so that we as a society can engage in these investigations and figure it out. Because that's the only way. I mean, we're supposed to be a self-governing country and world, hopefully, eventually. And, you know, right, unless you have information, you can't do that. You just get led around by the nose and scared and basically frightened into endorsing things that are really not in your best interest and certainly not in the best interest of the world. So, you know, I'd like to think that I know everything about these things, but what I really know is that unless we keep talking to each other and we keep investigating and we keep learning, we'll never know.
I just saw you are T.A. taking on the A.N. anti, no, anti, yes, S, P, A, spam.
Yes. Yeah, we are very concerned. I mean, I'm opposed to spam. When I was in private practice, I sued a spammer, and I got a $70,000 judgment against him, $65,000 judgment against him on behalf of my client.
R, E, A, L,
really?
real spam.
Yes, real spam. And the problem that we're having is we got approached by some organizations, I'm not at liberty to reveal their names just yet because we're still in the early stages, who run big listservs, big political organizing listservs, legitimate ones, who find themselves being blocked by what we believe are spam filters. And I think some of it is that the spam filters are very imprecise and aren't very good. And some of it is that they can be gamed. So if someone who doesn't like your political message can report you as a spammer and end up getting you blocked by a lot of other people, even if the people on your list have subscribed.
I have a L, a list, the Esalon.
Yeah. Do you get blocked by the spam filters too?
He has, yes.
Yeah.
Well, Mikey, you can talk about that more. There's.
Yeah, it wasn't clear if it was just like, it was actually the first time it happened, it was because of our ISP, our web hosting service, hosts a spammer. So yeah.
They
blocked everybody.
Yep.
So, you know, and then they wanted us to, like, put pressure on the SP to get rid of the spammer, which is, like, none of our business. And that was the first time it happened, but I think that's the one time I remember.
Well, here, what happens is that, like, there's a couple people that Frank will get the mail that have asked to be on his group that the mail will bounce back and the message for it will have to do with spamming.
Yeah, there's... I mean, one of the problems with the spam situation is the one that you talk about, which is that essentially they're punishing innocent people as a mechanism to try to they're making sure that they're blocking legitimate email messages as a lever to try to stop other people from doing things that are illegitimate. And my view is that the internet's far too important to be played with that way. That legitimate email needs to go through. People rely on this medium. I want people to rely on this medium. And if someone decides that somebody else has done something wrong, that shouldn't make my email held hostage. And, you know, what has happened is that the people who are finding spam, and I think that most of them, almost all of them, have very good intentions. I mean, I think spam is a real problem. It needs to be addressed. There's nothing about this issue that means that it, you know, that where I disagree with spammers. I mean, I've been on the internet a long time, and I think anybody who's been on the internet a long time is very concerned about spam. Because we've seen it grow and grow and grow. And I hang out with a lot of sysadmins, and I know what a problem it is for a lot of systems and the way it can clog things up and itself make legitimate email get thing. But frankly, I'm not willing to surrender legitimate email in this battle. I think that it's possible to formulate solutions that make sure that legitimate email gets through, even while we try to stop illegitimate email. And there are lots of things that can be done. I mean, part of the problem right now is that you as a sender don't even have a good idea what happened.
Right.
And often you don't even know that it's been blocked until somebody might just randomly say, hey, I thought I was going to get your listener.
Exactly, yes.
And to me, when people are doing, especially, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for political organizing and for the internet as a political organizing tool. It's one of the things that made me the most excited about this technology when I first learned about it, you know, close to 20 years ago now. And if we, you know, that requires real-time communication between people. It requires consistent communication.
Yeah.
That's what the internet gave us.
Right.
And if we take that away because of spam, then I think we've lost something incredibly important. And I for one, am willing to, you know, frankly, of all the things that the EFF wants to spend its time on, this isn't one that we really want to have to spend our time on if we don't have to. A lot of our members are not happy that we're participating in this debate. But if we lose the internet as a political organizing tool, a big political organizing tool, the folks we're working with have lists, you know, of hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, my view is that's how we regain our democracy and that the internet can be a great tool in that. And if we kill the internet as a tool for that, because of spam, then I think we've lost something really important. We have to work hard to not let that happen.
They. C. A. Call. Us. C. O. L. L. Collateral.
Oh, collateral damage, exactly. And I'm not willing to see legitimate email be collateral damage in the fight against spam. I'm just not. That would just break my heart. And so we're working with these groups. We're trying to begin to work not only with the people who run, you know, with I want to have a discussion with the folks who are making these spam blocking tools. One of the problems right now is that there are so many of them and they work so separately, it's very hard to figure out what happened. But also work with the listserv folks and try to make sure that they have mechanisms in place that, that don't, you know, result in them with a lot of people who don't really want their emails on their on their list. That list people who administer lists need to be conscientious.
Mine, my list is 200. There's 200 people on Frank's list. Yeah, and it's all, he doesn't even have, like, the listserv, he does it all himself.
You've got 200, wow, so, that's a lot of administration.
Yeah, but so there's no possibility that there's anybody on there that doesn't want to be on there.
Because
when someone asks to be on there, he puts them on. When they ask to be taken off, he takes them all.
And most lists are like that. I mean, we've heard stories of, you know, lists of 200, even smaller, being blocked. Now, EFF, our effector, our newsletter, has about 30,000 recipients, and we have a ongoing problem with various spam filters. In fact, the effector that went out with my note saying I wanted to hear from email list people who had trouble was blocked as spam. And the response that we get back from folks sometimes, because I have a sysadmin who's actually pretty diligent about trying to track down and find out what happened. Because after all, we're the EFF. We should be able to figure this out, right? And was told, well, you know, you just shouldn't use words like spam in your message, or you shouldn't put things in your message that say blah. And the idea that the answer to the spam problem is textual censorship of the words we can use strikes me as a clear indication that we're on the wrong track here. I mean, again, I've worked very hard for a long time to try to free up the internet from censorship. The idea that we would self-impose this, and I mean we, by I mean sysadmins and people who are techies, that's who I fundamentally feel, you know, that's a huge part of EFF's core constituency is people who understand technology, that we would censor ourselves and ruin this thing that we've fought so hard for. It just breaks my heart.
I. F. I. N. Find. That is the M-O, the most dangerous, K kind of censorship.
Right, is the censorship you do to yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, again, we have this community of people who really, in some ways, you know, are totally get it, right? Mm. With when in the name of trying to prevent, you know, indecent images on the internet or pornography that might be unsuitable for children, the government says we need to regulate. You need to not use certain words. We need to make sure that people aren't doing certain things. The internet community rose up as one, right? That's what the Blue Ribbon Campaign was about. Mm. That's, you know, and we won this tremendous victory in the United States Supreme Court in the ACLU versus Reno case. Mm. To not see that there's something similar going on in the thinking that we're going to do word-based censorship because we're afraid of spam. To me, they're not exactly the same. Mm. I think one has a much more pure motive than the other one maybe does, but they're having the same effect. Mm. And again, you know, it doesn't really matter to me where the challenge to free and open speech is on the internet comes from. It's part of the reason why, as the EFF, we work very hard against government censorship, but we also work against the censorship caused by intellectual property laws. To us, they're very different contexts, but it's all about keeping the pipes going. You know, I always joke sometimes that I think that we're the plumbers, you know, we are the legal plumbers for the internet. We try to keep the laws laws clear so that the information can flow.
We even need, we need the P.I. pipe.
Yeah.
We need the pipe.
Yeah, we need the pipes clear.
Mm.
Yeah, I think so too. So again, I mean, I'm hoping that because we all have the same goal in the spam fight. The same, you know, sometimes you have very different goals with the people who you're trying to talk to. But in the spam fight, we all have the same goal. There's nobody who's opposed to spam who doesn't want all legitimate emails to be delivered. And there's nobody on our side of this that doesn't want spam stopped. So we have the same goal. All legitimate emails get delivered. All illegitimate emails, wrong, you know, spam emails don't.
Mm.
So given that we have the same goals, it strikes me that we start from a good place to really begin a dialogue to try to make sure that both of these things happen. And I hope that's this, you know, that's how I'd like to approach it. I know that the folks who are running the listservs who I've been talking to would like to approach it from that view as well. And I think it's going to take both the folks who build the spam filters and the ISPs who implement them and the folks who are trying to send email messages really kind of having a real honest dialogue.
I need have T.A. talked to S.Q. Squid List.
Mm-hmm.
B.E. Because they have the S.A. same problem you have.
Yeah, I haven't met anybody who runs a large list, and Squid List is a big one, who doesn't have this ongoing problem. And I think there may be some, again, I think the solutions are likely to come on both sides. I think that the people who administer listservs, you know, there may be a list of things that are best practices for people who administer listservs, things like making sure you really take people off, you make it easy for them to tell you that they want to be off and that it really happens. And best practices for the people who are trying to filter spam and best practices for ISPs about this. I'd like to do this. I mean, I don't know that government needs to be involved in this if we all sit down together.
A. S. K. One ask. The. L. I. List. The listservs.
Mm-hmm.
And or the P.E.R. person who is getting it,
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there needs to be more transparency in the process so that whoever's sending the message has some way of knowing that the message isn't getting delivered so that they can fix it. And that the person who's delivering it has some way of knowing that something's been blocked. And I think that's a real problem right now is the lack of transparency in how this happens. And in trying to figure it out with folks who run the list, you end up learning that it's almost like a whack-a-mole problem, right? You can get on a white list here, but then they do something else that ends up blocking you. And then somebody else does something that ends up blocking you. And even the process of trying to figure out what's going on and why is incredibly difficult.
It took us days.
It took you guys days to figure it out? Yeah, I believe you.
It took you a few weeks to get resolved.
Yeah. I mean, there's a viewpoint distinction, I think. I think that the folks who are trying to block spam think like sysadmins, and they're having a sysadmin to sysadmin discussion and debate. And so if this sysadmin's bad at this sysadmin will block all the mail that's going to this sysadmin's sites. But what they don't recognize is that there's just all of us down here who may not have any relationship with the sysadmin who's getting punished.
I got an email about a week ago it was for a spam filter. And it had a little attachment that was a letter from, you know, the spam filter crew that basically was just kind of saying, we're going to wage war on the internet.
Yeah.
We're going to take down AT&T and WorldCom. We're going to just take them down, you know, somehow. And but there was, like, no regard for all the clients, all the people.
Right, all the real people who use it.
They're just going to go get them.
Yeah, you know, I joke, I call this and I'm trying to remember that it comes from an old science fiction book, you know, the Morlocks and I'm trying to remember that there's an old science fiction book where there are the technical people who run everything and then there's the rest
time
of us.
Machine.
I think it's in the Time Machine and they're called the Morlocks. And, you know, the Morlocks are having a fight. And again, when it comes to the Morlocks having a fight, I'm on the side of the Morlocks who are trying to stop spam. But I don't want to be collateral damage in that battle. And I think that again, you know, we risk doing something really bad to our, you know, wonderful new technology if we let this battle go so far.
In the M.E. In the meantime, S.P.A. Spam has tripled.
Yeah, it's getting bigger and bigger. And it's a serious problem. I mean, I don't mean to at all, belittle it. I think it's a real problem, especially from the sysadmin's perspective. I mean, it's annoying to us, but it can really shut down systems. When somebody tries to do a relay shot through your system and you get all the backups, it can take down systems. And that's, you know, that's just as bad because that's hurting legitimate emails too. I wish I had a magic bullet. I don't. I think more litigation is one way to go. And I don't think we actually need many new laws. I think that spam is, you know, most of the things that cause trouble with spam are already illegal.
If what are the laws?
Well, in the case that I handled in California, we had several things. This was a situation where somebody had relayed a spam shot through my client's computers and used his name as the return address. This is very common. Spammers usually use fake return addresses because they don't want to get the bounces. They often use other people for that. And it was fraud. It was libel, defamation. It made my client look like he was sending out these messages, some of which were for explicit sexual things. So it was even easier to get the judge to see why my client might be concerned about that. He has his own reputation. And his system was taken down by the reflex of all of these bounced emails back to his system. And in fact, the backup to his system was his employer, and his employer's computers took a hit. They were a little more robust. They didn't go down. But it was a tremendous amount of work to try to get it cleaned out and get everything back up again. And it was clearly illegal under the laws. It was defamatory. It was an unfair business practice under state of California law. It was a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violation, which is a law that says that if you exceed the authority that you have in someone else's machine and you cause more than $5,000 worth of damage, they can be civilly liable. Well, what, by relaying all of these emails through my client's physical machine, they had clearly exceeded the authority in that machine. So this, you know, California does have a spam statute, but it isn't enforceable by anybody other than the Attorney General. But it didn't matter. We had a very good case with all the old laws. We didn't need any new laws. Most of what spammers do is already, there's already problems with it.
How about the P-E-R, the person who gets it?
That's a little harder. You could get a harassment if somebody does it over and over again to you. But in general, again, because we are sensitive to the First Amendment.
2, 2, 22, they, K, E, they keep, C.
Yeah, changing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you don't know, yeah. It's tough. I think the person who gets it, there's laws in Washington State and there's laws in Virginia against spam that allow individuals to take causes of action against it. Frankly, they worry me from a First Amendment perspective because in general, they say that it's illegal to send somebody a message that that person doesn't want to receive. And I think that a democracy works best sometimes when people do get exposed to messages that they don't want to see. And I have a difficult time formulating a rule that would get at the things that we don't want and wouldn't cause collateral damage to the kinds of messages that we do. And this is why the EFF has been uneasy about a lot of spam legislation. Most of it is overbroad. And frankly, it's underbroad. I don't think the laws, I mean, there are lots of things that spammers do that are already illegal, and we can go after them. But the law is not going to solve the spam problem, I don't think, because a lot of them are outside the jurisdiction, right? There's a huge, tremendous amount of the spam comes from overseas. And it's very, very difficult to hold those folks accountable. And frankly, a lot of the people who are involved in spams, you know, it's a multi-level marketing scheme, right? You know, the whole deal is if you send out a bunch of spams, then, you know, your goal is to try to get just a couple of people to respond, but also to get other people to start sending out spams, too. Many of them are multi-level marketing schemes. And, you know, as long as there are people who are desperate and think they can make a quick buck doing it, it's going to be really hard. Those people don't have any assets that you can really go about back. Now, I got lucky in our case. They actually did have assets, and we got a judgment, and they had to pay it over a long period of time. It was 5 years that they had to make payments, but they did, and they paid it off. And I think that, you know, they had an injunction that they couldn't ever send any email without a real legitimate return address. But, you know, I worry about, like, taking that law and making it national. There are lots of people who use fake return addresses because they want to speak anonymously online. There are people who want to go and explore new sexual things. There are people who want to go, you know, who've got cancer or other diseases, and they want to be able to talk anonymously and freely about issues that might otherwise be difficult if they could be identified. And the Internet offers great opportunities for that. And I would worry about shutting those down.
How about M A S mass M A mailings to no mass mailings to O to P to people who don't A ask.
Yeah, I mean, those are protected speech usually. The problem that the Internet creates, it's kind of a tragedy of the problems, the tragedy of the commons problem, is that the mass mailings are protected expression and they're an annoyance. And part of the reason they haven't gotten so big is because it costs money. And it still costs, you know, even if you get a bulk mail license, it still costs money. Whereas email's free. for most people under most systems. And so the result is, you know, we have this tremendous benefit. We can communicate much more freely, and people aren't metered by the message in the way that they are with mail. But as a result, people abuse that. And again, it's, you know, I guess one of the answers to the spam problem would be that we just all start paying by the message for every message we send. But I don't think anybody wants to live in that world either.
The P O S T, the post, O,
office.
Post office, T R I, tried to get. E M.
Yeah,
email.
I remember that. Yeah, they did, and they were gonna. They were trying to figure out a way to make the email system like the post system, and I, you know, they even had models for payment as well. I seem to recall. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, but it didn't. You know, they got massively overshadowed by all the rest of us.
I always thought that was a UTUR urban myth.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they were planning on charging, but they certainly had pretty grandiose plans to try to do things like certified email. You know, email you could trust and believe, and they were looking at those issues.
Then
it was a while ago, though.
I talked to C A R L. Oh, Carl Bryant. He's a labor involved in labor. He's a postal worker, and he told us that actually was true.
Yeah,
it
I saw
wasn't
a couple.
An urban
yeah, no, I met some postal folks at a couple early conventions about the internet, and they had grandiose plans to try to take advantage of the technology. And you know, I think their plans originally were to try to make email easier for people to use, and private. Companies actually ended up doing that, and you know, so that you know, it became a lot easier. This was kind of at least my experience with this was early internet days where it was still quite difficult to use email, and I thought the post office was thinking that they could step in and simplify things for folks, but they got overshadowed by the commercial interests.
That would D S U S H U shut the email stuff down. Is that what you're saying? If people had to pay for it.
Yeah, I think it would. I think, well, I mean, I don't think it would shut it down, but I think it would change it so dramatically from the way it is and not in, you know, I think it would get rid of the spam problem, or at least it would reduce it. I think you would still have bulk mailers. You'd still have people who were, you know, the reality is that these things make money.
Us,
and
we, my, us, P, O, poor.
Right. Exactly. And yeah. I don't, you know, I think that one of the great benefits of this technology is that, you know, you need an initial investment to get a computer and get online. And, but after that, the quantity of mail you do is up to your interest, not up to your pocketbook. And that's a good thing.
A. L. O. A lot of P. People. You use L I L I B libraries.
I use libraries to send their email, and that's a great thing. I mean, and I have friends who've traveled all over the world and been able to walk into, you know, a library and use a computer, sometimes an internet cafe too, but I think it's been a tremendous thing for poor people to have access to this information. We need to do better. I mean, I think that that the digital divide is real, and we need to work to try to make sure that, you know, we bring all of our culture into the digital age and not just the moneyed part of it. But at least in the Bay Area, I think it's quite accessible. And in lots of places in, you know, remote places across the middle of the country, I mean, there's the whatever it was called, the E-rate. There was a small tax that was put on by the Clinton administration that went to wiring up schools and libraries. And that's where the money went. And, you know, lots of people were opposed to it at the time, but I think that it was well-meaning. It was trying to address this digital divide issue.
Mm-hmm. On the FLIO, no, on the flip side, C-O-R, corporate, is T-R, trying, to M-A, make it I-L, illegal, to F A S T fast D fast F O forward.
Oh, fast forward through commercials. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is the whole problem with the DMCA. That it gives so much more power in the hands of copyright holders to control how we view their works. And, you know, that you talk about the Replay TV case, where the creator of a digital VCR that lets you fast forward, actually lets you skip commercials, has been sued by Hollywood, basically claiming that anybody who doesn't watch the commercials is a thief. And anybody who makes a tool that helps people skip commercials is a thief assister, basically, as a contributory copyright infringer. It's crazy. And we're seeing the same thing with DRM for DVDs. They sell DVDs now that you can't fast forward past the commercials. Disney is terrible at doing this with children's DVDs, which I think is the worst, because kids see those commercials, have to see the commercials every time they want to see their movies. And they've disabled the fast forward function. And if you were to get a piece of software that would re-enable the fast-forward function, that would violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act provision against anti-circumvention.
If a h a c c hacker did that, we'd get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, well, that's what DCSS will let you do, right? And those hackers have gotten into a lot of trouble. Jan Johansson, who helped write it, was on criminal trial in Norway. Luckily, he was acquitted, but he's gone through a tremendous ordeal. 2600 Magazine, who I, you know, EFF represented, published this program. And they were prosecuted and dragged through a year and a half's worth of litigation. They were lucky they had us, so they didn't have to pay for the legal defense. But it was terrible. And one of the things that DCSS lets you do is circumvent the controls that make it so that you can't fast forward past the commercials. It also, the thing that it was created for and is most famous for, is it helped folks develop a player for DVDs for Linux computers, which didn't have a player at that time. But whether it's based on a claim of contributory copyright infringement or based on an application of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, what we're seeing intellectual property owners do is, you know, control more and more what we can do with their works and really shifting the balance in their favor tremendously from what the law otherwise would allow. I mean, a copyright owner has certain identified rights under copyright law to control copying and to control public performance, but they don't have a control over your private performance. But yet they're claiming copyright violation if, in the privacy of your own home, you don't watch the commercials.
S. So, what, when, you, B, you, when you buy a CRT, a tape, is not that tape yours after you've bought
it? This is the question. This is the question. I think that I think it ought to be. You paid down your, $14 or however much you paid, and you should be able to do what you want to. You should be able to use it as a coaster if you want to, or throw it across the room, or watch it in all purple rather than the colors that it's watched in, or skip the parts you don't like, or watch the same parts you like over and over and again. Those should be completely outside the copyright holder's control. But what we're seeing with these new technologies and backed up by new laws is that they're trying to gain ever more control over us. And it's particularly sad because right now we're suddenly starting to have the technology to let us grab a hold of our culture and not just sit back.
Yes.
And really, so that you can get a copy of a movie and decide to make your own cut of it and watch, show it to you and maybe a couple of your friends. You could, the most famous one of these was the Star Wars, the Phantom Edit, where somebody took a Star Wars program and cut out, all the parts that folks didn't like. The latest one, the Phantom Menace, where people didn't, or not the latest, the one before that. Cut out, what was his name, Jar Jar Binks and some of the other characters that people didn't want. And this was circulating around the internet, and it was generally agreed, I never saw it, that it was significantly better than the one that was released in the movie theaters.
That is why they don't want us to do.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And, obviously you shouldn't do that in a way that's confusing. Nobody should think that they're actually seeing what George Lucas wanted to put out. But
it is, it's called C-O collage.
Yeah, a collage and being able to take bits and pieces of things. And, we can do this now. We've got the technology that makes this much easier. And the idea, again, that we would shut it down rather than embrace it. And maybe make some limitations so people aren't, consumers aren't confused. Mm-hmm. Nobody goes to the video store and accidentally buys the wrong one. People need to know what it is they're getting. But within those bounds.
Don't S-E, don't sell it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's that ought to be at least initially a big piece of it, because you don't want to compete. Somebody invested a lot of money to create that movie, and you don't want to basically be trading off what they did. But cutting people off from using their own initiative to view something in the privacy of their own homes, that's how they'd like to see it. Just when the technology lets us finally do that, strikes me as kind of crazy.
Or A R T artists,
right,
who C create a new piece, P I P I E, a new piece.
Yeah, no, and that's what a lot of hip-hop and a lot of electronic music is taking a collage or panache of a lot of different music. And, again, I think it's a whole new art form. Mm. It's not even all that new anymore. I'm just revealing myself to be old. But that should be celebrated. And instead, these people have never-ending problems getting clearances, having to pay so much money to get the little piece that they want that it's not worth it. That suddenly that creating the work is much more. There was a great exhibit that was called Illegal Art that was in New York a while back. I think it's going to be coming out here, but I think it might be illegalart.org. If you do a Google search on it, you'll be able to find it. And they gathered together a tremendous CD of songs that have been the subject of litigation over copyright, and then most of it for sampling of one kind or another. And it's great. It's such a you realize how much creativity has been squashed by this.
A. G. Again. That is the R. E. Real. T. A. Target.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I don't know. Again, I won't take. You know, you're absolutely. Your opinion is one that's shared by many.
they don't want any. They don't want things. They don't want some. They don't want anything that they don't control.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's certainly fair, especially financially. I think that they want a piece of everything. This is the thing for Hollywood, is it that, and one of the things that I think is going on with these intellectual property overreaching is really vertical market integration. You know, Hollywood has long wanted to control, long wanted to control the means, the tools that we use to view their works. I mean, when movie projectors first came out, they tried to use the patent laws to say that nobody could show movies unless they paid them money. Not just money for the renting of the movie, but really they wanted to control all the movie theaters. And then, of course, VCRs. I think most folks are familiar with the fact that we, you know, almost didn't have VCRs. One Supreme Court justice away. It was 5-4 that we got to have VCRs because Hollywood sued to get them pulled off the market. In fact, you know, we lost Mr. Rogers this week, you know, and everyone who cares about, you know, copyright freedom, and certainly who has a VCR should send a note of thanks to Mr. Rogers, because Mr. Rogers was one of the first TV personalities to come forward, and he gave a declaration in the case against VCRs where he said, "I think the VCRs are really important because my show comes on during the day in some places so that parents and children can't watch it together. And I think that it would be tremendously helpful for parents and children to be able to watch my TV show together. They can talk about it, and it would be a good family thing to do. So I support VCRs because then you can tape Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and watch it later with your kids." And I personally, and I'm not alone in this, think that that was a tremendous part of the reason why the Supreme Court said, "Oh, goodness, we can't ban this technology. We can't go against Mr. Rogers." And so we all owe him a big debt of thanks for our VCRs. You know, I keep waiting for the, you know, Mr. Rogers equivalent for the digital VCR to come forward and say, "I don't like my kids seeing all these commercials. I'd like them to be able to watch quality television." And frankly, we have commercials on public TV now much more than we did when I was a child. But even on commercial TV, there's good shows on commercial TV for kids, but they've got to see all these commercials in between. And I, you know, I'm hoping that there will be someone like Mr. Rogers who will have the gumption to stand up and say, "I think a digital VCR that lets parents make the choice about whether their kids should see these commercials, especially see them over and over and over again." If you've ever watched Saturday morning TV, you realize that's what happens. To stand up and say, "I think that this digital VCR is a good thing for families," just like Mr. Rogers said for original VCRs. We're still waiting. So I hope it'll happen. But because of the, you know, I think it's important that people, you know, as these new tools get released, sometimes we don't know what use they're going to be put to when they first come. And when the VCR first came out, nobody thought that there would be this tremendous market for rental VCRs. That was not in any of the, I've now read a lot of the reports and work that was done before the VCR was introduced, and nobody envisioned that video rental market was actually going to be what happened. And I think for a lot of these technologies, it's really hard to tell at the outset what's going to happen, and to take the initial uses, even if they may be things we don't like, and ban the technology based upon that is really short-sighted.
F. U. Funny. I. G. O. I got. S. Shit. Is this about the VCR? Is that what you mean? Frank was going to the San Francisco Art Institute for a master's in performance video right at the point where the home VCR was just starting to happen. And at the time, all the students used the 3/4-inch video, mm-hmm. and you could, you know, it was, you could take it out. That was part of being a student there, mm-hmm. but you had to buy your own tapes. And the tapes for a 20-minute tape was like $20-some, and it was like cost prohibitive. Right. So there was a point where we were able to go out and buy ourselves a VCR system, mm-hmm. and with the camera and the deck and the whole thing. And the shit he's talking about was the students and the teacher said, you're never going to show any of your work shot on VHS.
That's great.
Right? So, well, too bad, because that's what I can afford. Yeah. You know, so...
Yeah. Well, and I've noticed, you know, this little teeny camera you're using to do this webcast. I mean, this is just, you know, I highly doubt that the people who first developed small little cameras like this thought, oh, great, you know, somebody be able to do a simulcast web, you know, TV show using this technology. And that's the beauty. And, you know, that's one of the things that's so exciting about technology. What do they say? The street finds its own uses for things, right?
Yes. S-A. Again. That is how, that is why they are that is why they are scared.
Scared, yeah. Well, I think you're in good company with this view. Not enough. I would like to see, you know, more people use Napster than voted for Mr. Bush. And it strikes me that if those same people actually wrote their congressman and pushed, we could fix some of these laws. We could limit them. I mean, copyright, unlike a lot of things, you know, the copyright is very, it's a flexible doctrine. And what we heard in, you know, what I think was a decision that made me very sad, Eldred versus Ashcroft, that just came out about the Copyright Extension Act, what the Supreme Court said in that decision was copyright's very flexible. Congress should decide how copyright works. And we're not going to step in and second guess them. Well, that worked in the favor of Disney in that thing. But I think that if enough of us stood up, again, more people use Napster and I think currently use Morpheus and Kazaa than voted for our current president. If all of those people were to stand up and say, we actually want to reform copyright so it works for us and so it's not a tool of censorship, I think we could get it done. I mean, the amount of money that Hollywood gives to Congress, I mean, people are always concerned about, you know, the buying, you know, the fact that Congress is very swayed by campaign contributions. But if you look at how much Hollywood gives to Congress, it's not very big compared to some other lobbies. And so I don't think it would take nearly as much to try to change the direction of copyright law as it would say to maybe try to go against some of the civil liberties issues and stuff where folks are very concerned about being patriotic.
But
it's not such a hard, I don't think it would be such a hard thing.
But people don't know that PUBLI public DO domain is in DA danger.
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think people don't understand exactly how pervasive copyright law is in their lives. I mean, you know, you and I can't walk down the street singing a song without an exception to copyright law, right? That's an exception. It would otherwise be a public performance and be made illegal. And some of this is that the technology has suddenly made us have to deal with this area of law that didn't used to affect us very much.
L. You. Lover can, may, be, I, illegal, if it was a internet radio station?
I don't know what lover is.
Well, lover is what we're on.
Oh, this?
That's
okay.
Lover, L-U-V-E-R.
Oh, okay.
If it were a radio station, it may be illegal. Is that what you said?
Because you guys play music?
Well, we do, you know, we pay BMI, ASCAP, and somebody else. CSAC.
Yeah, but that's only for, well, it depends. I mean, the webcasting licensing is a whole separate thing, and it has its own separate rules and such. I mean, there's the so you're paying the publishers, which is a piece of it, but there are...
The RIAA is the main thing I think Frank is thinking of. They were not involved with that at all.
If you have a band that's going to play music, that you can, you know, there are certain ways that you can play it, but if you're going to make copies and stream, then you got to go into the webcasting licensing thing, which is its own deal.
Yeah. Did you understand that? Would you repeat that?
That you know, I'm just apologize because I'm not an intellectual property lawyer. I lean on others for a lot of this stuff, but I know that for webcasts there is a separate webcasting law that paying the BMI and ASCAP and those sorts of things is not sufficient because you need to pay the actual people who own the rights to the songs, which isn't the BMI ASCAP is only one of the many licenses that you need in order to play music for public performance. And for webcasts, there's a separate law. For other things, there are other laws, which is why it's complicated to do something like Napster or Morpheus, because you can't just pay the little fee that you pay for BMI ASCAP and CSEC. You have to do more than that. That's because you're making copies, and with webcasting, sometimes you're making copies available too. And I apologize, I'm not remembering the ins and outs of it. Copyright law is incredibly complicated, and it's got all these twisty little turns in it. And, you know, I'm a First Amendment lawyer who got stuck into the copyright battle. So we have a couple of copy. We have three copyright experts, intellectual property experts on the EFF staff now. And we're probably going to hire another one because it's such a mess. In order, you know, and they figure it all out and they come to me and then I say, well, you know, here's the problem. So here's how we're going to go forward to try to fix it. We all work as a team. But you know, as I said, I think copyright law is funny because it was this big, it's this big complicated mess of a statute if you've ever tried to read it. And it never really mattered because normally what copyright law was, you know, radio station wants to do this. Well, they have a consent decree to do things for the radio stations. But, you know, if you wanted to take somebody's music and do something with it, well, it was usually big entity talking with all their lawyers, talking to another big entity and all their lawyers. And what the digital revolution did was it gave all of us the opportunity to use our art and to play with our culture in a way that we couldn't before. And suddenly, now we're held to the standard of this incredibly complicated legal system that doesn't work for real people very much.
You, our, see, you, culture.
Yeah, it's our culture. Yeah, and there isn't much recognition of that fact in copyright law. Copyright law views us as the audience, right? That we're just the recipients. We sit and we take. And the idea that we would create, that we would take it and make it our own and create with it, is something that copyright law doesn't really give us much space for. I mean, there's public domain, which is good, but it's endangered. There's fair use, which is good, but it is hard because it's a defense to copyright infringement. And so as a practical matter, you really run a big risk if you use something that you're going to get sued and dragged through a big lawsuit and only at the end of it going to be declared that what you did was fair or not. And this is what's going on with Craig Newmark of Craigslist and the other people in the replay case. You know, we sued to get it declared legal to use a replay TV to skip commercials and to send shows and to library shows. And, you know, if they didn't have, you know, five lawyers working for free for them, they'd be drowning. I mean, the you know, we're almost drowning, the five of us, you know, trying to go against the big Hollywood cadres of lawyers. So fair use is great in abstract, and it is because of fair use doctrine that we get to use VCRs and that we get to sing when we walk down the street and all sorts of other things. But as a doctrine to actually help people move forward and have do new things, it's hard. I don't think it's the best of all possible models. On the other hand, it's got some good things in that it's flexible. And when, you know, I have techies tell me a lot of times, well, just tell me what fair use is, and then I'll encode it in the system, and then everybody will have fair use. And I say, well, you don't understand. Fair use changes over time. And at the time that the VCR came out, nobody thought that, you know, that if you had encoded fair use in before the VCR was developed, you never would have encoded in the ability to use the VCR. So it's, you know, it's a bug that it's kind of vague and it changes over time, but it's also a really strong feature. I think creating mechanisms where if you want to make a new use of something and you're afraid that you might end up being sued, you can, you know, you can go ahead and do it. And then as soon as somebody threatens you, you can go to a court and very quickly get a determination of whether what you're doing is fair use or not would be really helpful. And the law isn't set up that way right now. I think that would be a nice fix. And I also think that getting Congress to be a lot clearer about fair use than they've been in the past would be very useful, too. There's a couple of good bills. Boucher Doolittle is a good bill that's going to try to clean some of this up.
Yeah.
And Zoe Lofgren has a bill as well.
The R I the risk.
No, the RIAA.
RIAA. Has R U rules. Yeah, let's see. Stuff like limiting how much you can't play a whole CD all the way through, and you can't play the same artist so many times in an hour or some those kinds of rules.
Yeah, these are part of the webcasting rules, and there's a similar set of rules, I think, for radio, although it's got some variations because I know that you can do things like KPFA has the Grateful Dead Hour. They are able to do that. But the webcasting has these rules in them. And, you know, I think that they don't make a lot of sense.
W-H-I, which is why lover would be illegal.
Yeah, that's it. It's the CARP rules. They're called the CARP rules. I don't know what that stands for, actually, off the top of my head. But, yeah, it's the webcasting rules. That's why you would be illegal, because of the so many songs and all of those other regulations. And it's interesting because I have been told, you know, those are the kind of basic rules. And then you can go to the RIAA and negotiate changes with them. And I know some folks who've tried to do that. And while the RIAA is willing to negotiate a bit on the price for littler radio stations, if you're big enough to be able to talk to them, but they won't negotiate on those rules about the number of copies and things. And I'm puzzled about them. I'm not sure where they come from. Obviously, I think there's some kind of profit maximization argument. I guess if they can play the whole CD, then the argument is somebody would tape it and then they wouldn't have to go buy it. I think the idea that they're losing significant market because of that is crazy, but I don't understand the no more than three songs in a row. There's a couple of other little rules in there that puzzle me. I'm sure that they have done demographic studies and there's some kind of market maximization going on for them. That's why they insisted on them. But
I and the P A P paper. Paperwork?
Yes, the paperwork is awful. And that's actually the biggest problem for a lot of the small stations. Now, they got it reduced a bit, and it's kind of fragmented now. There's different deals for different size stations. The original CARP rules were awful, and EFF actually represented quite a few small stations who were opposing to these rules when they first came out. And there was a cutoff made for some smaller stations, but I don't think it's good enough. I think there's still a pretty heavy overhead of paperwork, and I'd like to see some exceptions. I mean, the big issue in CARP is funny. It's another collateral damage issue. I think that the RIAA doesn't care very much about little teeny webcasters. They may a little, But this was a lot about them negotiating with Clear Channel, which is the big owner of all of our media these mm-hmm. days. And they were trying to get leverage against Clear Channel. And that's a lot of these rules are kind of envisioned that the folks on the other side are really big folks. And part of the reason we were able to get some exceptions cut out of it was because I don't think the RIAA did care that much about the tiny webcasters. They were just collateral damage in the fight between the big dinosaur of the RIAA and the big Tyrannosaurus Rex of
yes.
Clear Channel. But that doesn't make it any better. It's just, you know, for understanding why some of these rules came out the way they did, it's good to kind of step back and see what was really going on between the parties and the fact that little webcasters just got crunched in the middle.
I can W O I can work with BMI with the paper Frank has managed to get it so that we don't have to do any of
that's
the paperwork.
No, I think that they're making deals for little folks, and that's one good piece of good news that folks ought to know is that you shouldn't just read the rules and give up, because again, I don't think the rules are aimed at little guys. I think that they'll give people exceptions.
Yeah, they did not want. They did not give us a exception. They just gave up.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ways to skin a cat, you know. If that's how you win that way, that's just as well.
Frank just kept emailing him back.
Yeah,
you know,
I think persistence pays. And again, I think that in some ways persistence paid off in this instance because, again, the focus of the rules isn't people like you. The focus of the rules is this fight between the two big behemoths. Nobody hates, you know, the RIAA. Really doesn't like Clear Channel and Clear Channel's because they've got to pay payola to get on the radio. I mean, whatever they pay these fees to try to get play on the radio stations, and you know they're in a big battle, and in some ways the rest of us are trying to just not get hurt in the middle in the webcasting context. Obviously, in other contexts, I think they're taking on consumers directly.
Even four Y years ago when IST started Lover WE web stations were F folding in anticipation. They just had kind of heard about these things and they folded.
Well, they published this thing that said, well, you're going to have to pay money in 5 years. We just don't know how much yet.
Right.
And I think that scared a lot of people.
Yes.
And I think it's really unfortunate. I think it was handled so poorly. But, you know, again, I think that your story is a good one for people to hear that if you, you know, that there are ways around this, and persistence may be one of them.
Jay, you just do, it.
Yeah.
Just do it. You until they show up.
It depends on what you're doing. Obviously, there are certain things where you might not want to do that. And, you know, in some ways, that's what EFF is for. Call us, and we help people through lots of these things. But we also started the Chilling Effects Project, chillingeffects.org, to try to help people. Because, you know, there is, in all sorts of contexts, this problem where people are getting cease and desist letters, really scary lawyer letters for things that they're doing online, most of which, a lot of which are completely legal, some of which aren't. And we started this project with a bunch of Bay Area, actually national law school clinics, to try to help people understand their rights so that if they just do it and then they get a letter saying this is illegal, they can sort out for themselves – whether the argument that they're doing something wrong is correct, or whether in a lot of cases it's somebody just blowing smoke. We've tried to create a tremendous archive of information about the various sorts of legal claims that happen in cease and desist letters in all sorts of areas, in order to try to help people get educated. Because there's a lot of scaring of people going on online. And, you know, again, information is the best way to respond to that, is to know what your rights are. And so you can know whether, well, somebody's said I shouldn't do this. Okay, I guess they're right. I am really hurting somebody. I hadn't thought about it. And drop it. Stop it. Or, as we see in more and more situations, they're just trying to scare me. They're just trying to stop me from doing my rights. And no way I'm going to stand up. And, you know, one of the things that's been exciting in the last couple of years is that, you know, it used to be EFF. You know, we help a lot of people, but we were, you know, there weren't very many other groups, other folks out there to give people legal help, especially with intellectual property problems. And one of the things we've seen in the last few years is a real growth of other folks willing to do this. Largely, a lot of law school clinics, Stanford has a clinic, Bolt here in Berkeley has a clinic, the University of San Francisco has a clinic, and they all do various kinds of intellectual property. And then Harvard, we've got Maine, we've got other folks across the country as well, but here in the Bay Area, we've got really an amazing number of resources now for people who are facing these kinds of claims. And a lot of what we do is just help people sort out, you know, the good claims from the bad, and figure out whether, you know, what they're doing is something that's worth standing up and saying, no, this is the right thing to do. Or sometimes what we tell people is, you know what, you know, we think actually it's not okay what you're doing, or, you know, here's their legal claim, and the legal claim is pretty good, and just try to help people evaluate so they can decide for themselves. So we're really pleased at the number of people we're able to help now, you know, because it's not just EFF all by ourselves. And we still do plenty. I've got my five lawyers busy all the time. And the hardest part of my job is still telling people no. But luckily, now I can really find help for a good percentage of the people who need it.
We will see a call call you.
If you, hopefully you'll never need me. It sounds like you're very resourceful all by yourself. But, you know, you definitely call us if somebody gives you a hard time.
H-E-L Helms. Tried. Frank was one of the artists investigated in the early 90s
for
obscene art.
The whole Maplethorpe and all of that?
Yes. Oh. Karen Finley, Annie Sprinkle. And Frank was
one of them. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't look like he stopped you much.
No. Then. Oh, and then the Berkeley City Council tried to mess with Frank's public cable access show.
No way.
Yeah, they actually, first they tried to get the BCM, the nonprofit that runs the station, to change its rules. And right now it's the 10 p.m. and after is adult programming, and the producer is the one who decides if what they're doing is adult. And Frank has always said that his program is adult, so it played after 10. And they tried to get the nonprofit to change adult programming to 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. And we got wind of it, and Frank wrote a letter to the editor that got published. And it eventually ended up in the San Jose Mercury News. Channel 7 sent a crew. We were in the AP Wire.
Oh, that's great.
And then, they don't like L-I-G. They don't like light. He said that he's shown a light on
him. Oh, because you showed a light on him, yeah.
Yeah, and they went scampering.
Sensors never like light. Yeah. That's why keeping the pipes clean is the most important thing we can, you know, is one of the most important things we can do.
Yes. What? Well, when they weren't successful with that, and then the city council said, well, we'll just pass a law. And it was only, and again, you know, Frank managed, you know, to keep it in the paper all the time, in the Berkeley paper, F-R, front page. We had a lot of front page articles. Yeah. And then the ACLU showed up and came to a city council meeting and wrote a letter to the city council and said it was unconstitutional, and it just disappeared. They had done already one vote and passed it, but their setup is you have to do a second vote,
right,
you know, theoretically to allow discussion. Yeah. And it just disappeared in between those two votes, and nobody will talk about it even.
Good, good, good.
Yeah, yeah. I know how to fight.
Yeah, you do. You do. And, you know, a lot of people are afraid to fight. They're afraid to stand up. And, you know, I mean, the model that you can, you know, provide for other people is, you know, in some ways much more important than any legal advice that I could give them. Is that what we need is people who are willing to stand up and say, these are my rights and, you know, I'm going to exercise them.
We then. Is this about the newspaper? Then the most recent thing is... there was a very good, it's right here, because I haven't put them away yet. A very good featured story in the East Bay Express. That's Frank and I.
Oh, yeah, look at you guys. Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Very bold of them. You know, they put that photo on the cover, and the editor said, much to his shock, they didn't get one complaint.
Wow.
And then there's a lot of photos inside that are nude.
Wow.
And, Frank said he thought it was the best thing ever written about what we do by the mainstream press. Really long, good article. And
I don't want to sit here and read it while we're on the air. Can I take one home?
Take it
I really
want to
read
a lot of them.
Okay.
And the article comes out, and Frank had at the time two things that he was a featured poet that had been booked months in advance, and it was happening the week that issue was out. The owners of the cafe told the host who had invited Frank, who runs the series, that she needed to get Frank to put into writing exactly what was going to happen at his poetry reading, and that it would not involve any erotic play, because that's part of what the article is about. They... always do, they always are, D-U, dumb, they always are dumb. Asking for, so of course he refused. He said that's censorship, he won't. He said, I have a firm policy never to say ahead of time what my performance is going to be. He said, but I'll tell you this, I always get asked back, figuring that was kind of a little wink, you know. And we're on our way out the door to the poetry reading, and I pick up his email right as we're leaving. And she says, well, in that case, you're canceled.
Aww.
So we went anyway. Mm. And they ended up calling the police. And they and actually, Frank ended up talking to the police, because Frank said, fine, we'll do the reading out in the sidewalk then. Okay. And the cop said, well, you know, you can't do that. The owners don't want you here. And Frank said, well, is it illegal? Well, if you block the sidewalk, it's illegal. Well, if we don't block the sidewalk, is it illegal? Well, no, it's not illegal. Frank said, great. Next reader. And he invited the cop to stay. And by that time, you know, the cop was our buddy.
Right.
And the owners were fuming, you know, because they couldn't make us leave. We did the whole reading. We were out there an hour. We had our little audience out there that came out. And then, but the gross part of that whole evening was the actual poets that had come, because it was like a bi-weekly thing or something. Mm-hmm. And the same poets that when they've heard Frank read before, he writes, there's this one poem in particular, Rant on an Open Mic, where he talks about, I don't go after the Hitlers or the McCarthys, I go after the nice people, mm-hmm. who didn't say anything as the train took their neighbors away and all this, and the poets, yeah, Frank. So here we are at this cafe, the poets all kind of go to the back of the cafe and get busy when this is all happening.
No.
So Frank says, push me back there, you know, and we go back, the cop following us.
Right.
Frank says, why aren't you out on the sidewalk where the poetry is? They're kind of doing this. And the cop says to the poets, are they with you, meaning Frank and I and Mikey? And they said, no, they're not with us. They're not with us. Like, oh, my God. Shame on you. Yeah. You know?
It's too bad. I had been so cheered by all the poets and the anti-war stuff. I thought that was a really amazing thing that happened. And
yes.
Obviously, probably, you know, it's a big community of poets.
I-H-I-H-O, hope, they, I hope in, I hope it is not, I hope it is not. A. Oh, like a sign of how things are going to be with people doing stuff like that.
I hope not, too. I think people are afraid right now. I mean, they've done an amazing job since September 11th of, you know, I mean, September 11th was really scary and rightfully so, but they've managed to keep the scare, right, and not let people relax. So, you know, and it's under the rubric of that scare that they've slid so many things into law that I think it's, you know, we'll see. It'll be an interesting thing to see the mettle of our society. You know, are we going to stand up? I mean, for every story like that, then you go to one of the protests and, you know, for me, my heart just fills at the number of people who are willing to stand up. We live in this bubble of the Bay Area where, you know, it feels like there is a unanimity, you know, that opinion is very strongly against the war, and that's probably not reflective of the rest of the country, at least not so strongly. But, you know, these are going to be trying times, and, you know, I think we're going to have stories of valor and we're going to have stories of great cowardice that come out of these times. You know, and I just hope that they're as short as possible.
We are NBA. We are back on CA campus. Well, that was the other thing that happened when that article came out. Frank had just lined up I think it was like an 8-performance series at UC Berkeley, sponsored by the Art History Department. That the Art History Department, the Theater Department, I don't know what other departments actually teach about Frank. Mm-hmm. And so now they're sponsoring him doing this performance art series. And the article comes out, and the chair of the department freaked out and canceled the series.
Oh. That's so sad.
Not the OFFI. That's not the right. We got
it's not the official.
The official reason is, oh, gee, I followed the wrong course and signing up for the room, and this is what the teacher sponsor said. And I'm supposed to be at all the performances, and I can't do that, so you're canceled, and I don't want to talk about it. And don't ever call me again. I mean, that was the vibe.
Oh.
But then when we talked to another teacher, another professor, he said, well, you know, I know the chair called me when the article came out and was freaking out. And
it's funny, you know, it always puzzles me, these things, because to me, free speech, while it is incredibly important, is, you know, what are they afraid of? Right? I mean, what is it you're going to do to people? I mean, you know, if you wanted to, you know, do an Uzi demonstration, I would be a lot more scared, right? But, you know, all you're going to do is expose people to ideas. And they'll either like them or they don't, you know? I mean,
they, that is what they're afraid of.
Yeah. And that always puzzles me, because it assumes that people aren't adults in some ways, that they can't decide for themselves what's a good idea and what's not.
They want control.
Yeah. Yeah. And it always, I don't know, it always, maybe I'm just, you know, a continual optimist and I'm always stunned. No, but you're an artist and a poet, and, you know, I may like your art or I may think it's lousy, but that we would not let it out strikes me as just not on the table, right? I mean, if nobody ever wants to come hear you and they won't book you into a club because you can't fill it up, well, okay. But as long as there's an audience, there ought to, the art ought to go forward.
W H I which which well, it is going, we actually, oh no, which is what, why, they, are, and, nervous,
right, because there is an audience. There is an audience, yeah. I think you're right.
People. We were actually kind of blown out. The first one we did, there was a large audience, filled the room up, and they were just like so ready for whatever Frank was going to dish out. You know, and I said, wow, Frank, it almost feels like we just booked the room, but everybody's kind of there waiting, you know. It's not like our thing. It was just so intense how much people were, you know, really,
really
hungry.
Wanted to hear, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then it was, yeah. Mm. We did actually get a student organization to sponsor it. And so it's
going to go on.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. After we, oh, well, we showed that she canceled it like 3 days before the second performance. So all the press was out. All we had put thousands of flyers out. And so Frank said, well, I'm just going to go, and I'll be in the hallway. I'll bring the poems that I couldn't read in Oakland, and we'll just do a poetry reading in the hallway. So we get there, and they had big canceled signs they had put up on the window, and they had the janitors waxing the floor. So coincidence. So you couldn't get in the door to get to the room. And so I thought, what are we going to do? We could stay outside. But the janitors knew us from the first performance, so they said, oh, come on in, the room is empty. Frank said, as I sometimes do, I did what I was told. So every time somebody walked in the room, the first thing Frank would say to them is, enter at your own risk. The series has been canceled by the university, so legally we're trespassing. Uh-huh. And everybody would go, oh, okay. And sit down.
That's great.
So we did a wonderful 2-hour performance. We did the poetry where Frank just had the audience take turns coming up and sitting down next to him and reading one of his poems. It was very powerful.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a continual battle, you know. I mean, I've been a First Amendment lawyer now for, 13, 14 years. And it never ends, you know, and there's always, you know, the urge to censor people never seems to go away. And it's, you know, I think you're right. It has to do fundamentally with this fear of free thinking and this want of control. And it's so funny because we have a country that was founded on the idea of freedom of speech and that was founded on the idea that, you know, the remedy for speech is more speech. And that this was to be a place for this, but, you know, so we have it even in our founding documents, and yet we struggle with it every day.
That S E E that seems S so S simple.
Yeah.
And O B and obvious.
Yeah. And I think most people think about it in the abstract and have no trouble with it. It's in the details that it gets hard. I don't think there are very many people who think, oh, freedom of speech, you know, that's a bad thing. You know, we've all grown up in the American educational system, and we all, on some abstract level, think that it's important. But when it comes down to hard things, when it comes down to, this is what I always say, you know, is that, you know, popular speech doesn't need the First Amendment. It's only unpopular speech that needs the First Amendment. And while we all play lip service to free speech, when it actually comes to the speech that needs protecting, we have much more checkered history. Now, frankly, we've got a pretty good Supreme Court on First Amendment issues now. I disagree with them on other things, but they've been pretty solid. Our first ACLU versus Reno, the attempt to try to regulate indecent speech, 9-0. You know, we had every justice say this is crazy. And we've had other good speech things. So, you know, there's some hope that it, you know, while there are lots of problems in our culture, this day, speech you know, while we still struggle, we've got the folks at the top who are the ultimate keepers of it actually get it in some pretty real ways.
Why are you a free speech? I mean, yeah, a First Amendment
free speech lawyer. That's a good question. Yes. It always spoke to me. I think I've always, you know, I grew up in the middle of Iowa in a pretty rural place. And the exposure to ideas and different ways of thinking, I think, was really important to me as a kid. And I recognize that part of the reason that I'm the person I am was because I got to, you know, I wasn't just exposed to the kind of narrow range of thinking that the folks in my little town had, but I had access through the library, through the media, to different voices. Now, as I've gotten older, I realize that even that was a pretty narrow strip, but it felt big to me as a little kid, and now I realize that it's even, you know, what I was able, you know, as a kid in the 70s and 80s in the middle of Iowa was actually still pretty narrow, but it felt big. And I think recognize that that's the key, for me anyway, to kind of self-development and self-growth was this access to information. I was a voracious reader as a kid. I read all sorts of things. I had parents who let me read things they probably shouldn't have at a young age, or at least my teachers didn't think that. You know, I used to kept having it notes from the teacher to read. You know, I think I read The Exorcist when I was in seventh grade, and the librarian made me get a little note because she wasn't sure. And, you know, in retrospect, it kept me, you know, I couldn't sleep for weeks. I was terrified. And it probably wasn't the best thing to be reading, but they let me explore. And they knew that, you know, the worst that was going to happen was that I might have some bad dreams for a while.
They always use kids as an excuse.
Yes, and I was lucky. I had parents who, you know, trusted that I could figure it out, or that the worst that would happen would be bad dreams. I think that they knew, you know, that it probably wasn't the best idea, but letting me have the control and make the mistakes myself was a good thing.
That was C-O-N-T control in on in you is W O R worth the N I nightmares.
Yes, having the control is worth the nightmares. Exactly. And I think just as I got older, I mean, I did a lot of human rights work. I still do international human rights work, things that are much more, you know, don't shoot the protesters sorts of things. But to me, freedom of speech has always been where it started. It's where I got my values. It's where I got my belief in, you know, in the way I see the world. And so I fundamentally think that my responsibility as someone who learned so much is to make sure that the pipes stay open so that the next generation of kids can make their own decisions. And the other thing is as someone who is interested in the courts and things like that, I mean, free speech is in some ways is kind of an easy thing, right? You can win with free speech stuff, and I like that as well, although it's still a battle. It's a harder battle than I thought it was going to be. You know, I kind of stumbled into becoming a First Amendment lawyer. I didn't pick it. In retrospect, it all makes sense, and now I can give you a neat little package story, but I essentially got asked to, I had done a lot of civil liberties and human rights work, and I got asked to defend a math professor who wanted to publish a computer program on the internet and was told that if he did that, he'd go to jail as an arms dealer. And this was the Bernstein cryptography case that I handled. And as a result of that, had to learn all about the history of the First Amendment, and especially its ties to scientific speech. And you know, went forward from that. And then from that, other cases came, and it, you know, it kind of built around this kind of structure of learning about the First Amendment in this one particular case, and it's just grown since then. So you never know where life's going to take you. If you'd have told me when I was a little girl growing up that I'd be, you know, doing internet law, I'd laughed at you. You just, you know, life takes you on various roads.
Like, I am, I was, R, E, A, I was reading, A, at, M, A, D, M, A, D, oh, Madison Square Garden, about the little kid. Well, Frank did a poetry reading at Madison Square Garden this past fall, and it was, so the audience was this mixed audience, all ages, and a lot of Frank's poems are what you would think of as like adult kind of stuff. Oh, and right, and so and I hardly had anything on.
Oh, what?
Because like when Frank does a poetry reading, somebody else reads his poems, and then he vocalizes and moves around and stuff. So I was like two people all the time, and so I was reading his poems, and I had this kind of performance dress, which is like just a dress with a lot of holes and strips. And so here we are, and then there's all these kids in the audience. And it's like, okay, well, you know, we're just going to do it. And the one family group of people Frank was particularly aware of was this elderly black woman, and she had a couple little kids, like under 10 with her. And so we read the poems, and then eventually we're walking through Madison Square Garden to go back to our table. It was like this film thing. And the woman, the older woman, calls us over, and Frank's going, oh, shit. I'm in trouble now. And she comes up to us, and she says to Frank, My little grandson, my 8-year-old grandson, who is a problem in school, we have problems with him, at the end of your reading, turned to me and said, Grandma, I'm going to do better now. She said it just blew her away.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes, that's great.
That is... what... see... censorship would S stop.
That's right. I think that's right. I mean, I think, and you never know what's going to speak to someone where, you know, and I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that we lose some of the best things to censorship. I mean, you look historically at the novels that have been challenged and the art that's been challenged, and they're, you know, many of them are the things that we now really revere. Ulysses, and you know, the idea that you know, I think that art that pushes the edges, again, you know, I may not like it, but that's how we grow, right? I mean, and you know, once you're an adult, you can choose, okay, well, I like that, I'm going to go see it, or I don't like it, but to try to destroy it, I think we lose the ability to move forward. It's a lot like science. Again, as I said, my First Amendment stuff is in science. It's the people who think new things and push the models and go against the grain. They're the ones who make the breakthroughs. They're the ones who solve the problems. And then other people follow and replicate their results and learn from it. I think art works the same way.
Yes, Frank always says that science and art is the same process.
I think it is. I mean, you know, there are...
it is E X E X P E R experimenting.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
M most experiments don't work. Most experiments fail.
Yeah.
That is the P process.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And so, you know, we have to deal with a lot of art that we might not like or that might be lousy, because it's in that mix that the new things that are really good emerge. And science is the same way. I agree completely. I actually think technology is a little the same, which is kind of an applied science. That people tinkering and playing, and it's one of the things that the EFF really has started to talk about a bit is this right to tinker, the right to take your tools and to play with them and do different things with them. It's the same idea, the same process. And I actually think that's what the First Amendment is about. It's about trying to I think if you look back at Jefferson and Adams and the people who were really involved in creating, that's, I think, what they were trying to do was to create a, in some ways, just a big open space where whatever's going to happen is going to happen, but we're going to create this space for things to happen. I mean, that's why in the First Amendment we worry about chilling effects. We don't just worry about things that censor. We worry about things that might make people afraid to speak. And we don't do that in other areas of the law. I mean, we don't worry about things that might make people afraid to, you know, walk, you know, drive their cars or whatever. But when it comes to speech, we create a buffer zone. Again, I really view it like this area, this kind of free area, free for all area, where people can really let their minds go free. You know, you can't hurt people. There's boundaries, but within those boundaries, we try to make as few restrictions as possible, so that the creative process can really have space to grow.
E. V. O. Evolution is being limited by the O V E over F O focus. The over-focus on C O R corporate P R O F profit.
I think there's a real risk. I mean, I think that the profit incentive can actually be a great creator of things as well. I think, especially again in the history of technology, I think we've seen lots of things that have come our way because people want to make money off of them. So, I wouldn't say that you know, that's, you know, there just needs to be a balance, right? There needs to be a place where there's a space to spend the time and energy to create something new because you will make a return off of it. And I think that needs to be protected as much as it needs not to get so big as to squash other things.
I was not the IDEA idea of C O copyright wasn't the idea of copyright. L I limited time.
Yes, and that's the Eldred versus Ashcroft decision that I think is terrible that the Supreme Court just came out with. Congress passed a law called the Copyright Term Extension Act. We often call it the Sonny Bono Act because it was passed after his death. That extended the term of copyright 20 more years. And this, of course, correspondingly reduced the size of the public domain because nothing's going to fall into it for 20 more years. And I think that, you know, when you add up all of the copyright extensions, it really has gotten to the point where limited time doesn't mean anything. And that's actually what the Constitution says. Is that copyright should be a limited time. My friend Peter Yahtzee called the Copyright Term Extension Act, you know, unlimited time on the installment plan. Because rather than just get rid of it all at once, we're doing it in little pieces. And I think the Supreme Court was just completely wrong in not noting the constitutional problem in that law. I think what they said was a little disingenuous, which is, oh, well, it's just not our business. It's just up to Congress. And I think it is their business to interpret the Constitution and to give those words real meaning, not just phony meaning. That's why I think they were wrong. I also think that it was a bit disingenuous given the amount of times they do second-guess Congress, that they would suddenly say, oh, no, this is the scenario where we can't. But I think the answer is in that we need to, well, first of all, I think that as time goes on, the situation's going to get worse and there will be other opportunities to bring this problem to the court's attention, and we'll certainly do it. But I also think, again, you know, if it's time to go back to Congress and say you need to do the right thing here.
G I S disingenuous. No, D I Disney. M A made. M money. M I L millions. On P H P U
on public domain. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, yes. What do you think exactly? I mean, Cinderella, Peter Pan. You know, all of these things, you know, they don't write very many original stories. Mulan, you know, even the ones from all around the world, they take other stories. And that's just the supreme irony, that they would then try to, you know, I've made mine, you know, now I'm going to shut it down for everybody else, is you know, I think it's just the height of hypocrisy. There were some great comics that came out after the Eldred decision with, you know, Mickey and Goofy learning that they'd been sentenced to 20 more years in the pen, and, you know, they couldn't come out and live their own lives. And I think that's exactly the right thing. You know, our Larry Lessig, who argued the case, is on the board of directors of EFF. And, you know, I know he is still really despondent at the loss. And I think it was a tremendous loss. On the other hand, I think that through the Eldred decision and the 2600 decision, some of the other things that we haven't been successful on, we've started to build a movement, and people are starting to get it. The number of, you know, EFF's membership keeps growing. We're a member or supported organization. There are a couple of other groups now in D.C. There's, you know, Public Knowledge and Digital Consumer, two groups that didn't exist before that are beginning to focus on these issues. So my hope is that, you know, as in the early days when folks were trying to fight segregation, you know, they didn't win those early cases. They lost some horrible losses. Eventually, they kept pushing and they kept pushing and they kept pushing, and things moved. And, you know, I think I'd slip my wrists if I didn't think that that's what was going to happen with these battles, too, is that, you know, we may not win the first victory, but we'll I think ultimately we'll win the last one.
Don't get E M B embarrassed, but I P U pushed E F F. I pushed E F F.
Oh, yeah.
This was a to get to get someone on the show.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. Oh, you did. Oh,
I
know about
certainly
it.
Know. Absolutely. It was something that we, you know, we just get a lot of requests, and it got bounced. And finally, I said, you know, we should do this. We all agreed. It wasn't a matter of us not doing it. But sometimes it's good that you're pushy, and it does good things. For us, it's generally just a matter of being overwhelmed.
E? Well? Well? Was it well? Yeah. That was... You, not, that was not the F I first R E S P response. Oh, months before all this happened, Frank had emailed, and I can't even remember the name of the person. Yeah, okay. But she ended up writing back and saying, why should I come on your station? What relevance does your station have?
Yeah, this was our executive director. She didn't know. She tried to go on your website, and she didn't get it. And, you know, I think it was just a failure of her to understand, you know, what was going on. And you know, I wasn't sure either what to expect. And I think that, you know, because you do a lot of, you know, out there sexual stuff, we didn't want that to be a part, because it's just, you know, we're our private lives are our private lives, but as EFF, you know, there's a face, you know, and it doesn't need to get, you know, we defend the right of people like you to do what you do, but if we were to be involved in it too, it would get blurry. And so, you know, in general, we don't. And so I think she was a little concerned, and she wasn't quite sure the difference between some of your performance stuff and the show. And, well, you know, that's what she was asking. I don't think she was opposed to it, but I think she was confused.
Like the poetry reading?
I think that was, she wasn't sure what this was, and whether it would be an interview or whether it would be something more participatory. and so I'm not sure. I mean, I have to ask her, but you know, we looked again and saw this other thing that you did as well. And so, you know,
and only if they, only if it, only if she, be, e, only if she begged.
I'll tell her. And I think she was just a little puzzled. Sometimes we do get requests for folks to do things with EFF that are not appropriate, and we do have to say no. And, you know, some of it is, but in large measure, a lot of the times that we say no is just simply because we just don't have the resources to do all the things that folks would like us to do. But we try real hard for, you know, real interviews to talk about real issues to be available. And that was, I think, what she was trying to suss out.
P A S T past S H I S H O shows past shows R A archived.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, and I think she just took a quick look and was puzzled and wrote you back real quickly. And then we looked back again, and I, you know, we, obviously I'm here because we realized that this was something that was much more like what EFF wants to do, which is talk about our issues with people.
K. E. Kevin Danaher.
Oh, Global Exchange.
L. O. O. Looked. G. Great. In. The. In the. N. Nude.
Oh, well, you know, those Global Exchange people, they're crazier than we are.
P. P. Peter Dale Scott looked great in the nude, too.
Well, I'm glad that we didn't, you know, that we got over our initial confusion, and I'm very glad to have got a chance to talk to you.
We C O covered A. We covered a lot.
Yeah, we did. We talked about a lot of things.
No. No thing. Nothing. No time. For. Erotic play.
It's true. There are too many.
There's too many issues. M. U. U. Can see you can come back.
I don't think Sherry would like that very much. I'm happy to come back and talk about our issues again. You're really well informed, and I, you know, really appreciate the chance to come and talk about with somebody who not only cares about these issues but lives them. You know.
Kevin Danaher. Tried. He tried to come for a shorter period of time.
Oh.
It took us months and months just to like work out scheduling stuff, and we finally got a date. And then like an hour and a half before he was supposed to be here, he called up and said, "Hey, now how long is this show?" Which, you know, he totally knew how long it was. At P U. He's a punk. So Frank called him a punk the second he walked in the door. But Frank said, "Well, 2 hours." He said, "Oh, no." He said, I don't have a babysitter for 2 hours. How about if I just come over and we do like 45 minutes? And the vibe was like it's taken us like so many months. Let's just do it. Frank said, "No, I think I'll wait and we'll just reschedule again." And he did. He rescheduled and he came. And like, you know, 2 hours later, you know, Frank said, "So look at the time." Because he kept saying, "You know, 2 hours of talking heads, Frank, come on now. We can't, isn't there going to be any music or anything?"
Yeah.
But he said, I was wrong. Yeah.
No, I mean, I think you're a really good interviewer for that because I thought it's a long time too. And, you know, because Kevin, and I'm sure he's a little like me, and I do a lot of interviews. And, you know, it's nice to have 2 hours to really be able to talk things through. But on the other hand, it's a little daunting to think, oh my God, you know, if this person doesn't know what they're talking about, they're going to run out of questions and I'm going to have to try to fill 2 hours. That is not, you know, I mean, I give speeches and all, but that's a long time. So I think, you know, there's a hesitancy for people who do interviews to think that there's anybody who can be informed enough to be able to fill that time with interesting things. And so, but that's certainly not the case. So.
Yeah, and it's over 2 hours.
It's time.
Yeah.
Well, I need to go home and go sleep because I've got a big day tomorrow.
Yes. So we should give out all your why don't you give out contact info and website?
Sure. EFF.org, electronicfrontierfoundation.org. It's really easy to find. And from there, there are links to, I mean, we've talked about everything today. We've talked about USA Patriot Act and the post 9/11 stuff. We've talked about intellectual property laws, the Replay TV case, and some of the other cases that we're doing in that. The 2600 case that we handled, which we lost, which is over, and some things about the Eldred case as well. It's all pretty easy to find if you go to the main website. There's a search engine. Type in whatever you want. We have one of the biggest archives of legal materials related to the internet in the world, and so there's a lot there.
I use some of your N news stories. We love our alternative news. It's a daily news program.
Oh.
And 5 days a week. And two of those days are stories that Frank selects and Teresa reads. And so he sometimes picks stories from you guys.
And that's the other thing, of course, Sherry doesn't let me go out without asking people if they think that what we're doing is important to join us because we're a member-supported organization. We have, I think it's over 8,000 members now. But we need more. You know, when we speak, we want to be able to tell members of Congress, well, we speak on behalf of a big community of people who are concerned here, and it does a lot of good. And of course, it also is how I pay salaries and hire more lawyers to do more work. So, if you think what we're doing is good, we really urge people to join and become a member. And our newsletter, you can get our newsletter even if you don't join EFF. It comes out about once a week, and I think I'm glad to hear that you use it. I know a lot of people who do. We try real hard to keep it topical and interesting, but also really cover, you know, the stories, not just the headlines, but the stories, you know, day to day, what's going on in these battles. And to get it past all the spam filters.
And to get it past all the spam filters. Yes. There. This. A. This will be on So you'll be able to see this show, or you'll be able to hear it archived on lover.com, the Shaman's Den archives. It will also be on the Radio for All website, archived there as audio. And it will play on Berkeley Public Access TV on Frank's Unlimited Possibilities show. Can, may, maybe, S. Oh, San Francisco Public Access, where we have someone who's sponsoring us there also. Yeah.
Great.
Okay, and it, your name, Cindy Cohen.
Cindy Cohen. Yeah. I'm the legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Forgot about that.
Yes. I. N. E. I never. Frank's real bad at introducing his guests.
Well, that's all right.
Well, we do at the end. No. It is on P-U. It's on purpose. He does that on purpose.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Start the conversation before the camera starts.
Okay.
So people kind of step into
something.
Ease
into
something.
It better. Yeah. Yeah. That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, your player is going to stop. Hit play again for some music. And then later tonight, Susie Block is on at 11 p.m., followed by we'll be playing the last UC Berkeley performance following Susie Block's. That'll be about 11:30 p.m. Pacific time. Player is going to stop. Hit play again.